So I would like to say a few things that go along with or are supportive of what Lee's been talking about and the role of samadhi and how it fits into the path of practice, at least in how the Buddha presented it. And I like Lee's translation of samadhi, or word for samadhi, indistractability. It's a great word. And the word distraction or distractability comes from the Latin word to tear apart or to take apart. And the core of the word, the tract part, is the same, in Latin, the same word as track. So distrack, to go off track, go off course, is one of kind of the meanings. And so, you know, to lose the path, to lose our path in life, our direction we're going, or to be taken apart. And so part of what samadhi is coming back together again, what was taken apart. And one of the things that has been taken apart, or what we're separated from, is that we've become separated from our minds when we're distracted. So we're kind of lost in our, you know, involved in our thoughts and everything, and there's a separation of ourselves from ourselves almost in that being lost and preoccupied and with things. So samadhi is partly this collecting together, gathering together, bringing together, and so we can go back on track, back on the course or on the path. I'm very fond of the word samadhi, probably because of the associations I have with it. I, like Lee, I agree that the English word concentration is not a very useful translation. It leads many people astray. Many people interpret that to mean you're supposed to be in the control tower in the head and turn on the laser and kind of zap things. Samadhi, the word samadhi is used in two different ways. It refers to a faculty that we have, a mental capacity we have, and it can refer to a state of being. And I think that more often than not in the suttas, it refers to a state of being and not to the faculty. That's my guess, looking at my sense of it. And the faculty sometimes is related to being one-pointed or being kind of at one with things. And sometimes the words used rather than kind of one-pointed is being unified. It's gathering together. So it's kind of the mind's capacity to gather or unify itself, so it's all working together for the same purpose. There's nothing within us which is distracted from itself or pulled apart from itself, but everything is working kind of in harmony or working together for the same purpose at the same time. And it's not too difficult to consider that there are times in our life where we are pulled apart and our mind is mind and all the different parts of who we are operating across purposes from each other even. You might sit down to meditate and you might have, you know, you have really sincere and dedicated intention to really sit and stay present and meditate on the breath perhaps, and you know, been waiting for a long, long time to be able to come on retreat and be able to do this practice, and this is really important for you, and yes, this is what you're going to do. And you sit down, and but it's the sit before lunch. And so you start wondering, well, I wonder what they're having for lunch today. And it seems like lunch is more important than you. So you're off thinking about lunch. But then also you're kind of weak from being hungry. And so you feel this kind of draining weak, and you're concerned about what it means. And then, but then just before you came into the hall, someone cut you off at the door and snuck in before you. And like, what's this? We're on a retreat. And how could they be so disrespectful? And you're still a little bit fuming inside. And then, you know, there was something about the rain that reminded you about vacations. So you're thinking about vacations and lunch and worried about your stomach and the person who cut you off and the energy, and all this stuff is swirling. And it's kind of like we're pulled apart in all these different directions with our thoughts, our body sensations, our emotions, our intentionality. And, you know, it's not, we're kind of divided in a sense. And so part of samadhi is unifying, bringing ourselves together and kind of learning how to apply ourselves or be fully just here with this experience, not divided. In doing that, it becomes a state of being rather than a singular mental activity we do. And so it's like a whole sense of being present feels, it can feel many different ways. I'm reluctant to put too many words on it in case you think this has to be your way. But, you know, you can feel, the word that I really like for samadhi is to be composed. And I like it partly because it's so nice to feel composed. I feel like being composed is something you do physically. If someone tells you compose yourself, most people would kind of start doing something with their body and relaxing their shoulders and really settling in. Be composed here, settled. And also because the etymology of the word samadhi is the same etymology as the word compose. And so to take a stand and be settled and firm and, you know, be here in a full way. And it's a state, and as a state, it's something we settle into, or something we allow to arise, as opposed to something that we will into being, or that we kind of get, tight and focused in a tight way. And so to allow a state of being to arise certainly takes relaxation, it takes certain conditions to be in place that allow something to arise. A state is not something that you manufacture or, you know, it's not an act of will, but it does require having certain conditions and creating the proper conditions. And as I've talked about earlier, a big part of the teachings of the Buddha has to do about are contributing the conditions that supports the unfolding of the practice within us. And the practice doesn't unfold willfully, something that we will or something that we cause to happen, but rather it's something that we create the conditions to let it unfold or let it move through us. And the Buddha gave a number of similes to explain this kind of and as natural unfolding once the conditions are there. And one that he used is a simple one of a plant growing. A farmer plants the seed, but the farmer doesn't cause the plant to grow. The farmer creates the conditions for the plant to grow by, you know, tilling the soil, maybe fertilizing it, watering it, keeping the weeds away, and then the conditions are there for the plant to grow. And so the same analogy for our practice. There's a seed that we plant, maybe our intention, and then we create the conditions. We water it, support it, but we don't go around and start pulling the plant, you know, stretching it out of the ground, you know, like grow faster, you know, stretch, you know. You have to kind of trust and allow the natural process to happen on its own. Another one delightful analogy or simile for the natural process is Buddha talked about how an egg, if a hen sits on its eggs, incubating it, and it's getting time, you know, it sits there long enough. The Buddha said, even if the chicken has the thought, I don't want these eggs to hatch, the eggs will still hatch if the conditions are there to support it. There's a natural process that's unfolding with the eggs and the embryos growing inside. At some point, they'll crack open, even if the mom doesn't want it. That's quite an amazing thing, that if you put the conditions together for your practice, even if you don't want to get enlightened, stop it. You know, if the conditions are right, it's a natural process that's what'll happen. And it also kind of maybe saves us a little bit from taking too much credit for doing the practice, and it's all up to me, and, you know, look how great I am. Our job is to incubate something, create the conditions. And I think samadhi is part of the incubation. It's kind of, maybe that's the incubator. It's a wonderful container. The state is a wonderful container that allows for an unfolding, a movement, a growth, a breaking out of the shell that we're trying to do here. The last simile is one that the Buddha uses a lot, and that is of rain, like, you know, it's rain we have. And so if rain falls on a mountainside, and at some point the mountain soil is saturated, and the rain will start flowing down, raindrops are flowing down the hill, and those drops will find other drops and become bigger drops, and then they form little trickles of streams, and then those trickles of streams become bigger streams. They become creeks, and then the creeks find each other and become rivers, and then becomes a mighty river that goes eventually out into the ocean. And that's a natural process. The water will follow the pull of gravity and will flow down river, unless there's something which is blocking it, an obstacle. And if it's a big obstacle, you know, then it builds up, backs up the water for a while. But someone might come along and remove the boulder, remove the stone or the obstacle, and then the water will flow again. So in the same way, there's a point where our practice just begins to be like water flowing down river. And long before I knew this simile from the Buddha, the simile that I made for myself, which I don't know, maybe it's kind of unfortunate simile given how cold it is, the simile, but it worked for me. It was like a snowball rolling down a hill, and as a snowball rolls, it gets bigger and bigger. And that's how at some point I felt the practice was unfolding. And so it's a natural process that you have to kind of allow to happen. But you have to. Your job at some point in practice is not to put obstacles up. Or if there are obstacles, your job is to remove the obstacles so that natural flow can continue. So these three similes, idea of the natural process, is quite a phenomenal thing. And one of the things is to convey today, is a sense of maybe like awe or amazement at what our inner psychophysical processes are capable of. It's kind of like standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon and looking, you know, it's like, wow, look at that, the time span and all the processes that, you know, eroded away these rivers and created these canyons. Or looking out across the Pacific here on the coast here and just seeing the ocean, and, you know, there's something awesome about it. And so there's something really miraculous or amazing about what the human mind, the heart, is capable of doing in spite of ourselves. Or if we get out of the way of ourselves, we don't have to orchestrate or make it happen. In fact, it turns out that taking too much responsibility as being the one who does it, who makes it happen, just is just another obstacle. And so then, well, we might as well go to the beach and hang out and do nothing, right? You know, and then I'm not responsible, I'll just kind of hang out on the couch and watch TV. Just let the natural process happen. And you just, natural process will happen, then you'll get out of shape. just endless days sitting there on the couch watching TV. No, you have a role to play, a very important role, but that is a role of creating the conditions. And sometimes it takes a lot of work and effort to create those conditions, to get the conditions in place. So, if, for example, if we're very distracted, and sometimes it takes a lot of work, manual labor, to come back, let go, relax, settle away. But how you come back is important, because if you come back with too much self, or too much fury, or too much like a jerking the mind around, it just agitates it more. So is there some way that you can come back, or let go, or soften or relax back into your experience that feels so nice or so right that of course you want to do it? You can't wait to do it. I can't wait to get distracted because it's so nice to come back. I have this nice way of doing it. Something I did, I've done sometimes, and that doesn't always work for me, so don't expect it's going to work for you. But there are times when it works for me, is my mind begins to wander off in thought, and I don't let go of it. I don't fight it. I just kind of ride up next to it, like a wild horse which is out running, so you have to bring it back. So you kind of ride up next to it on your horse, and you ride along with it. And then when I'm riding along with it, then I kind of turn around and guide it back. Right here, Gil. Come back here. And I find that so harmonious and peaceful and kind of fun. To kind of, you know, it's not a problem. I'm not a thought's not my enemy. It just a little bit needs a little extra help. But I kind of need to trick it to come back by getting up next to it and turn around. So anyway, so that may be a little silly, but it worked for me. And I've noticed that there were times I used to jerk my mind back, the jerking approach to being mindful. And, and now I find myself wandering off in thought, and I'm not particularly troubled with my mind going off in thought. It's not a problem for me. But I know it's so much nicer to be present. And so sometimes I don't even let go of my thoughts now. I just let go into my breathing. I let go into the present moment again. And then the thoughts kind of fade away. And that's, you know, rather than something I have to let go of, it's just like, come, you know, show up here. So sometimes that's manual labor and it's hard work. Sometimes it's more pleasant and we find the pleasant way to do it and it's more enjoyable to do. So this natural process, and the Buddha talked a lot about this as a natural flow, but there had to be conditions in place that set the stage for that to happen. It wasn't just wishful thinking. And so, for example, one of the things that was supportive of this was confirmed confidence, or a better translation is maybe I'll just say confirmed confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. That faith and being confirmed, you know, it brings a kind of gladness and happiness and inspiration. And the confirmed confidence, what it means is that we know what the Buddha was talking about. And the example the Buddha gives in one place is one knows that one had greed in one's mind, and then one noticed the greed's not there. And rather than some big mystical spiritual experience, you say, oh, that, the freedom from greed, that's what he's talking about. And that's valuable. One notices there's lust in one's mind, and notice when it's not there. Maybe because it's kind of dropped away, kind of in a bigger way than usual. Ah, that's so good. That's nice. One has conceit, and one experiences no conceit for a few seconds. And then, ah, And there's something about seeing those simple experiences of the presence and the absence, which is one of the key understandings that leads to a confirmed confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. It's kind of a phenomenal thing that something so simple and maybe psychological has such a big role, especially in when people in religious world or Buddhist world sometimes have these grand theories of what the practice is about, and kind of looking for some great mystical thing or something. But it's kind of very grounded, simple, and then to be inspired by that confidence, to be, and the word that's is gladdened. Other places the Buddha talks about, without specifying what it is, talks about being inspired by something, and that strong inspiration is what gives birth to the water flowing down the river, down the hill. Other places he talks about doing Brahma Viharas, doing loving kindness practice, and the loving kindness practice creates the gladness that then sets the stage for the flow. and then elsewhere, like Lee said, it's abandoning the hindrances. And there's this gladness that arises. And so it'd be over and over again, the Buddha talks about something that's inspiring, something that is very meaningful, that happens to us, that inspires gladness. And the word is pamoja. I kind of like the word delight, but gladness is usually a translation. And for a long time, I didn't quite understand this, how this worked. Until one of the things that really helped me a lot was to realize that I had a tendency of not validating or being interested in gladness or joy. You know, it's like that's not really where I was too busy doing the practices. I was too busy trying to get something. I was too busy, you know, with my projects and my important life activities and my, you know, I have important anxieties to deal with and, you know, be anxious about, or I have important, you know, resentments that I have to kind of get on with. You know, because time is short in this life and I have to get through my list of resentments before I just, you know, there's not enough time for them all. So there's all these important things to do. and so for me, joy or gladness wasn't kind of in the picture. And it didn't help that I practiced in Zen, where there was very little discussion about joy, and where the father of Zen, all the depictions of him, has a very different kind of smile than Lee was talking about. He has this upside-down smile, like the negative smile. And so sometimes it's kind of like this, like you have to, you know, be stern or kind of grim, you know. It turns out that I think there's the furthest from the Buddha's mind that practice involves grimness and being stern and pushing and demanding. There's kind of an expectation that, you know, sooner or later there's supposed to be some gladness and joy. And then I slowly started to learn that there was a lot more joy, a lot more happiness and gladness available in the present moment than I had allowed myself to feel. You know, I don't know if some of you saw the hail. It happened during the meditation, right? So maybe you didn't see it. See it. I got to see it. It made me glad to see the hail, especially since I was inside looking out. And the kind of a gladness and delight in seeing the hail. And, or, you know, walking out in this blue sky and, just, you know, it's kind of nice. It's maybe very subtle. And, but it's, I know for me, I can easily kind of be so caught up and concerned and distracted by what's so important for me that I just kind of going on my next thought, my next concern, and I don't notice that the sky is blue. I don't notice that I just had a nice meal. I don't notice that I'm sitting with a group of very nice people and who are dedicated to the practice. I don't notice that it's kind of remarkable to sit in any facilities that's set up for meditation and group people coming together, it's kind of like remarkable. Because so these kinds of simple kind of delights are available much more than we tend to avail ourselves of. And this is not positive thinking exactly. It's not like Pollyannish. It's not like making everything sweet and wonderful. But rather, it's a willingness to not be caught up in our preoccupations and instead take the time to appreciate what can be appreciated that's here already. And in particular, as we get into the practice, and the practice, we offer our practice, we're doing it, we're doing the effort, the work that it takes. At some point, learning to appreciate the goodness that arises with it. So take the hindrances, for example. If you're trying to be present and not distracted, the hindrances help you be distracted. And so you have to kind of work with the hindrances and learn to work with them wisely and let go of them or relax them or find your way with them in some way or other. At some point, the hindrances are weak enough and the mind, concentrated mind, is strong enough that we don't wander off into the hindrances anymore. And it's such a relief. Like, oh, I can't believe it. I'm finally here. And it not only is it wonderful, but it feels so ordinary. I mean, this is what the natural mind should be like. What was I thinking? What was I doing being off in those? This feels so good. Especially since it took so long to get here. So when that used to happen to me, it never occurred to me that I should feel glad about that and delighted or appreciate that because I have important practice to do. I have to get on with it. So there's always more to do. Okay, now let's get serious here and bear down. But rather, to take the time and appreciate, oh, this is nice. And then kind of the little Buddhist troll in the back says, you're not supposed to enjoy anything. Enjoying is a form of attachment. Let go of that enjoyment. You can just reassure the troll. It's okay. The Buddha himself encouraged us to experience the joy and the gladness. It's part of the path. So it's not easy to experience these things, but it is part of the path. And so we're creating the conditions where at some point we're able to see, oh, this is nice. Some point we're inspired. Wow, you know, this path really makes sense. I'm glad to be on it. I know for me, I'm just so happy to have this Buddhist path to walk. And I don't really care that much exactly how far I get on the path any given day or any time. I just find it so wonderful to be on it and take the next step. It's so great. So like Lee's example of going to Denver. I guess it would be nice to go to Denver. I've never been there. You know, so I suppose it could be nice. If I go to Denver, I hope that on the way there, I enjoy going there more than I fantasize about Denver. That the path there is enjoyable and nice to do. So then the Buddha talks about this gladness arising, and then it gets more interesting, and this is when he starts describing this natural unfolding, this natural water going down the hillside. And he says that when the mind is glad, joy will arise. He doesn't say, when the mind is glad, next work on getting joy, being joyful. You know, kind of puff and puff and bring it up. He says, once it's glad, you're kind of there. But what it requires, I think, is that if you have some kind of gladness or delight, it does take kind of being present for that, kind of allowing for it, being open for it, without greed, without conceit, without any complications. Very simple, almost innocent. Ah, this is nice. And then that has a chance, if there's momentum, and that gives chance for joy to arise. Then he goes on to say, for someone who's joyous, tranquility arises. The body becomes tranquil. For someone whose body becomes tranquil, happiness arises, or sukha. And when someone becomes happy, they become concentrated. I wish someone had told me that when I started meditating. That's how you get concentrated? I thought you had to be, you know, really bear down and grit my teeth and try to really kind of forcefully get concentrated. You're supposed to first feel happy and relaxed and tranquil and at ease and glad. It's kind of a little bit hard to believe sometimes. But it can work this way. So what it requires is this idea of putting the conditions in place. So what are the conditions that you put in place? So one of the conditions that the Buddha talks about that puts in place this gladness is being ethical. And that was one of the big surprises to me when I went to Thailand and first started practicing in Thailand. They were talking about being happy because you're ethical. And that didn't compute in my little poor little mind. What? I mean, I associated with being ethical with being kind of goody-goody or something. It was like it wasn't a good thing to be ethical. It wasn't that I wasn't unethical, mostly from a lack of imagination, probably. But so I wasn't particularly I wasn't unethical, but the idea of somehow I got the idea that being ethical was somehow, I don't know, just not kind of, someone was a little bit off or something. I don't know what it was. Remember, I was very young, so I was young and unlearned something. But they go to Thailand and discover that there could be joy and delight from one's own ethics. It was a foreign idea. And I was part of this awe and amazement was to discover in that first long retreat I had in Thailand that I could have that too. That I could feel, I could experience physical sensations of ethical integrity, or kind of something, and then feel the goodness of that, the delight of that. Ah, this is something you can enjoy. And it's supportive for this process. So in this description of going, I call it the gladness sequence. Gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. It's described as a natural process. One thing moves to the next. And this sequence occurs in this passage, and it has to do with virtue as a condition. And it's the language is quite remarkable. The Buddha said, for a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no intention needs to be exerted. Let me have no regret. Let non-regret arise in me. So if a person is virtuous, behaves virtuously, you don't have to make any effort to feel non-regret because there's no regrets to let go of. It's natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person whose behavior is virtuous. So again, I think it's quite remarkable, at least for the Buddha, he's expecting that there's something about being virtuous that will naturally give a rise to a state of having no regret. But then he goes on. For one without regret, no intention need be exerted. Let gladness arise in me. It is natural that gladness arises in one without regret. So the question is, to make sense of this, is how do you go from having non-regret and being virtuous to being glad? What is the way for you to find that, find your way and somehow figure that out and in a way that's sincere or natural or appropriate for you. And is that something you can avail yourselves of, that you can kind of allow yourself to feel and take time to feel? I heard many years ago someone said something like, well, I heard some conversation with a teacher and then, well, you know, I don't know if I can feel glad about my virtue. And because the person had done some interesting things. And then so the teacher, well, I think teacher said something like, you haven't killed anyone in the last week, have you? No. You haven't stolen this last week? No. You haven't engaged in sexual misconduct this last week? No. You haven't lied in the last week, have you? No. You haven't intoxicated yourself last week? No. Be glad for that, for this last week. Use that as the basis for being at least that modicum of well-being. So I don't know if it worked for that person, but I'm not telling you that it's easy, but I'm suggesting that the fact that the Buddha gave these kinds of instructions, maybe it's worth considering, is there some appropriate way, natural way for you to avail yourself of this gladness that can arise? So, and then it goes on. I'll shorten the rest of it. It repeats the same statements. It is natural that joy arises for one who is glad. It is natural the body becomes tranquil in one whose mind is joyful. It is natural to feel happiness in one whose body is tranquil. It is natural that the mind is concentrated in one who feels happiness. It is natural that one who is concentrated knows and sees things as they are. It is natural that one who knows and sees things as they are becomes disenchanted and dispassionate. It is natural that one who is disenchanted and dispassionate realizes knowledge and vision of liberation. And that, it's a kind of this, it's a flow of liberation, it's this flow of water down the hill. One thing flows to the other. And part of the key is gladness, and part of the process is joy and happiness. So in one discourse, the Buddha lays out a whole bunch of practices that are part of the path of practice, the path of liberation. There are practices that are useful for a healthy life, and there are practices to be done that are good to get yourself on the path of liberation. But when the Buddha described the path of liberation for itself, he described a set of five practices that could be done that lead up to the jhanas. So the first one is to abstain from unethical behavior. It's a little bit different than saying being ethical. It's saying abstain from unethical behavior. And the second is abstain from attachments to sense objects by safeguarding oneself with each sense experience, each sense door. It doesn't say guard the sense doors. Some people, when they hear that practice, it just feels like they have to kind of tighten down and shut down and not be present. What it says is abstain from being attached to what you see and hear and smell by staying attentive at the sense doors and kind of watching over yourself there. So if you see something, you kind of can see yourself wanting to go for it, and you kind of don't let yourself, you abstain from the attachment if you can. The third is to have mindfulness and clear comprehension in daily activities. So whatever you're doing, be really there present for it. Be aware and connected to what you're doing, and then understand that what you're doing as you're doing it. Be present for what you do. It's interesting on a retreat like this to spend some time as you go about the retreat center and through the day to notice what are the activities that you do where you are least present, where you have the least awareness and clear comprehension of what you're doing. For some people, it's as soon as they go into their room and close the door, and they're in their own privacy, and they kind of just let go of the practice and mindfulness, and they go kind of like mindless for a while. Some people are mindless, become mindless when they go to the bathroom, or maybe in the shower, or there's some activity. Is there some activity that where you actually, you know, are not practicing mindfulness and clear comprehension? The fourth practice is contentment. So practice contentment with what you have, within reason. And the fifth one is what Lee talked about, is abandoning the hindrances. Three of these five involve letting go. So abstaining is a kind of letting go of unethical behavior. Abstaining from being attached to sense pleasures is a kind of letting go. And then abandoning the hindrances is a kind of letting go. And contentment could be a letting go of discontent. And then there's the mindfulness practices. What's fascinating is that the four practices having to do with letting go, the fruit of those practices, what that letting go brings about, is some kind of happiness. Letting go for the Buddha is associated with becoming happy. Letting go is not only about what you let go of, it's also about what you gain. And you gain happiness. So abstaining from unethical behavior brings the happiness of blamelessness. So no one can blame you for anything. You can't blame yourself. So there's a happiness. When I was younger, I never would have imagined that that was possible, that I could let myself be happy for this. Abstaining from attachments to sense objects brings undisturbed happiness, the happiness of a mind which is not disturbed or troubled by attachments. Abandoning discontent brings the happiness of contentment. And then abandoning the hindrances brings gladness. So I think it's kind of remarkable. People often associate letting go when they come to hear Buddhism, read about Buddhism. Some people have a very strong negative reaction to these party-pooping Buddhists. It's all about letting go, and it's like world-denying and diminishing ourselves, and somehow you can't have a good time. Turns out that letting go, the purpose of letting go is to be happy, to feel good. So do you know how this works for yourself? Do you know how to let go so you feel good, you feel happy? I know for me it's been crucial that I learned to do that for myself. Because I noticed at some point that if I'd gotten relatively good at letting go of all kinds of things, and in letting go, sometimes I ended up being neutral. And after a while I noticed that if I was neutral and congratulated myself for letting go, I hadn't really let go. That I only let go if in the letting go there is some kind of lightening. I don't know what to say, joy or gladness, maybe that's too strong word to this, but some kind of lifting and lightening and in the domain of gladness. Only if it felt good, there was a goodness to it, a rightness that, oh yeah, that's good. Neutral is not good enough for letting go. So it's a higher order of letting go, to let go in such a way that in the act of letting go, it's like, ah, this is good. So what does that look like? What does letting go look like if it's supposed to bring that kind of sense of well-being in the letting go? So much so sometimes that letting go feels so much better than whatever pleasure came from what you're holding on to. Wow, this, give me more opportunities to let go. This is great. So then the abandoning of the hindrances brings gladness. And then Li described how that then moves into the jhanas. And also what's remarkable about how the Buddha presents the jhanas in his practice is that he doesn't talk about jhanas as something you're supposed to do, like actively do or will. The language of the text is it happens. You put the conditions in place and it happens. But one of the conditions that has to be in place requires being really present for the experiences you're having. This idea, this is why mindfulness is such an important skill to learn, because mindfulness is a skill to be fully aware and present for what's happening. Without that being there as a condition, the gladness, the joy, the happiness can't do its work. It can't work on you. It can't unfold. It can't flow down. It's kind of like with plenty of mindfulness, clear awareness of something, it's kind of like the obstacles are out of the way for the water to flow down the hill. It's like the channels are open and something can move through us. And so this idea of something moving through us or emerging or allowing something to come up, allowing something to move through us, is a profoundly respectful thing to do for ourselves. And we don't know what's going to move through us, what needs to emerge. Sometimes it's difficult material that comes up. But to kind of have this ability to be present and allow in the deep intimacy or deep connection or awareness showing up here for this in a full way. But do it with a sense of a willingness to be changed, a willingness to be open, a willingness to allow what needs to surface and move through you to move through. This sense of willingness or an allowing. And at first it might feel like what you're allowing is the big story, the big event. After a while, the big story is the allowing itself. That open channels of just allowing like this. For a while, it might feel like you're prying your cold hands off some what you're gripping and holding onto to allow something to flow, or you're afraid to let things move as they are, to give up control. But at some point, it just feels so good. Ah. And after a while, maybe it doesn't matter what you allow, because just allowing is so great. It's just, ah. It's like, you know, you hold your hand in a fist for a long time, just the fact that you open it is good. Opening is so much better than what you're holding on to. So it seems that this flow into the jhanas is part of this natural process. Our job is to be present. And our job is to be present for the right things, the things that are supportive for this process to unfold. And it turns out that joy and happiness is one of those things. And Li talks about pleasure, experiencing pleasure fully, and then as he said, that once you kind of get yourself into this state of concentration, I can tell you that just like Li said, what the Buddha said, the only thing he says what to do in these states. Is enjoy it. Really feel it. Feel the well-being that's there, whether it's joy or happiness or whatever that sense of well-being that's there. Allow yourself to feel it fully. Allow yourself to come and fill you. Make space for it. Let it be. Don't get attached to it too much. Don't be greedy for it. Don't be conceited about it. Those are all putting boulders in the creek. Just get out of the way. Get out of the way. Allow it. But allow it to emerge. Allow it to emerge. Allow it to bubble up. Allow it to spread into your being. And for me, it's very a physical thing to do. It's like you open the pores of your body to allow this stuff to move through and to kind of flow, trusting the emergence, trusting the arising. And so if you can feel some, it doesn't have to be much. And sometimes when people hear about jhanas, they think it has to be, you know, powerful, powerful forms of joy, which it can be. But some people, that's not how they're constructed, to have these strong states. It's more mild. But they open to it, and that mild happiness and joy spreads and moves, and they get open to that. And then the way the Buddha describes going from the to the jhanas, it's not something we do. What we do is to enjoy each one thoroughly, and then when the momentum is there, when the openness is full enough, and there's enough concentration, enough samadhi, enough subtleness, composure, then at some point there's a transition into the next one. And then you enjoy that. And then transition to the next one. And it's a transition into things that are more and more satisfying, more, in some ways, I think, more nourishing, nurturing, more peaceful. And part of the reason for this, part of the usefulness of this samadhi practice is the many benefits that come from it. For some people, it's very healing. It's very healing to no longer be torn apart, stretched apart from oneself, at war with oneself, or have parts of ourselves which are, you know, feel deeply hurt or afraid. And to be able to bring ourselves together in a way where there's no anxiety or fear, and has a sense of well-being and safety, this tremendous sense of safety in these states of samadhi. And to feel the sense of safety and the goodness of them can be very healing for some people. It's like, you know, it's a kind of reconditioning. People learn a certain kind of conditioning when they're young, and sometimes it's not so helpful, that conditioning. And then there can be a reconditioning that can be as deep as going back into, you know, getting the right conditioning as a child that really makes you feel safe in this world, at home in this world. It's very healing. The other is that it is a reconditioning. And even if there is not some deep, you know, struggle in life or something needs to be healed, it provides a powerful conditioning of feeling at home, feeling safe, and feeling confident. To be confident, to have deep trust in this world and life, to be able to just be present and feel like it's trustable, just to be open and present and alert. To be confident, to be strong. These states can be very strong and give a sense of strength. Some people describe themselves feeling big, kind of powerful. The analogy that I like to use is that of if a fly lands on an ant, it's a big deal for the ant. If the fly lands on an elephant, the elephant doesn't care. What would you rather be, the ant or the elephant? Samadhi is a way of being the elephant. You get to be kind of confident and present and strong. But if you start becoming conceited and make a self out of that, guess what happens? You start shrinking. Pretty soon you're an ant again. Ants are okay, but they don't mind it being used for this analogy. So the samadhis can kind of recondition us in a very different sense of how to be in the world and how to be present and be alive. And can be wonderful. It kind of creates a different conditions. It creates a condition where it becomes easier to keep letting go. Keep letting go. And then as Lee said, that when the mind is very clear and very stable and very centered and focused, that and we're not distracted, and we don't have the agitation of a lot of thoughts and ideas, we see much more clearly. It's like we can see right to the bottom of the lake, because the lake has become completely clear. And we can start seeing clearly in a way that we couldn't see before. And the more clearly we can see, the easier it is to let go, to release. And we can let go of some of the deepest places of holding we have. And in the Buddhist sense, the function of all samadhi is not for its own sake. The function for it ultimately is so that we feel the safety, we feel the trust, we feel have the clarity, we have the strength, we have the confidence, so that our system can continue this natural flow, natural unfolding, that allows something inside of ourselves to give away, to drop away, to let go. Something inside of us, which is not you, is waiting for you to finally put down your burden, finally let it fall away. And it's a wonderful thing. So we create the conditions, and one of the conditions is to be present for our experience. And that's what we offer. We look for other conditions to put in place, virtue, love, goodness, appreciating the process, being on the path, having a practice, our faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, whatever it is, and then abandoning the hindrances that start giving us a sense of well-being. And then not just kind of letting that well-being be in the back room, but allowing yourself to really receive or take in or register that well-being in the field of clear awareness that mindfulness is. And then allow the process to unfold. You don't have to direct it or expect something to happen. That lady did a very good job beginning the retreat emphasizing the uselessness of expectation. The Dharma knows what to expect for you. That's enough. You don't have to know. All you do is offer yourself to the Dharma, to the practice, to being present, to showing up. And there's this amazing process, miraculous process, like standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon in awe. You can stand on the edges of your heart, look in, and be in awe of what's there. May you sit quietly, dedicatedly, and allow this inner process that's waiting for you, make room for it, and allow it to unfold as it does. So, thank you. And to transition back into the retreat kind of mode, we can take a minute just to kind of get composed, and then I'll ring the bell and we can continue with our day.